and proceed with the prior will. However, they were bickering over who would serve as executor. Jonah, the oldest, had been appointed by Francine 5 years ago, but he was having heart problems, brought on by the stress of this situation, and probably couldn't serve. When Mr. Chatham mentioned replacing Jonah with a substitute executor, a fight started amongst the other four. He was currently trying to arbitrate matters. Samantha dropped the bomb about the mysterious package they had received the day after the funeral. She made sure Mr. Chatham understood that neither she nor anyone at the clinic had any desire to get involved in a will contest, but it was important for him to know that his clients were lying. By the time she hung up, he was mumbling incoherently to himself. She faxed a copy of the last will to his office and left to tell Maddie. "That'll really piss him off, won't it?" she said when she heard the news. "One threat and I'm going to the sheriff." "Should we get some handguns?" Samantha asked. "Not yet." She tossed some papers across the desk. "Take a look." It was thick, whatever it was, and Samantha sat down. "What is it?" she asked as she flipped a page. "Strayhorn. Notice of appeal in the Tate case. I talked to the trial judge late last week about the alleged settlement. Needless to say, he was not sympathetic, so we're screwed. Now we have to slog our way through the appeals process and hope the Supreme Court doesn't reverse. Why am I holding this? I thought you might be interested. And Samantha, we need you to handle the appeal." "I think I saw this coming. I've never touched an appeal, Maddie." "You've never touched most things around here. There's always a first time. Look, I'll supervise and you'll learn quickly that it's just a lot of paperwork and research. Strayhorn goes first and files their thick brief in 90 days. They will allege all manner of grievous errors at trial. We respond, point counterpoint. In 6 months, almost all of the work is done, and you'll be waiting on oral argument." "But in 6 months, I'll be gone," Samantha wanted to say. "It'll be great experience," Maddie pressed on. "And for the rest of your life, you can say you handled an appeal to the Supreme Court of the Commonwealth of Virginia. How can you top that?" She was aiming at levity, but it was clear Maddie was anxious. "How many hours?" Samantha asked. She was calculating quickly and already thinking that she could do virtually all of the research over the next 6 months before she left. Donovan swore it was a clean trial, nothing major to quibble over on appeal. "I'd guess 500 hours, from now through oral argument, which is about 15 months away. I know you'll be gone by then, so one of us will handle that part. The heavy lifting takes place now. Annette and I simply do not have the time." Samantha smiled and said, "You're the boss. And you're a dear. Thanks, Samantha." Andy fired back, "Dear Miss Sam, thanks so much for your lovely epistle. You've gotten so soft in only 3 months. Must be all those cookies. If I read you right, you want some assurances that you'll be, 1, adored by your bosses, 2, worshipped by your colleagues, 3, appreciated by your clients, 4, virtually guaranteed a partnership which will lead to a long, full, happy life, and 5, given enough office space to make you happy, in spite of the obscene prices per square foot now being demanded by Manhattan landlords, our clients, recession or not. I'll see what I can do. Attached is a bio of Nick Spain. Oddly enough, he's had just one divorce and has been married to the same great gal for about 15 years now. As you'll see, he has no felony convictions for rape, child abuse, etc. Nor has he been indicted for dealing in child porn. 2, he has never been sued for sexual harassment or anything else for that matter. His divorce was no fault. He's actually a great guy, I swear, a Southern guy. Tulane, Vanderbilt Law, with impeccable manners. Odd for these parts. Later, Andy. The spy phone buzzed at 2:30 as Samantha was rereading Strayhorn's notice of appeal and reviewing the rules for appellate procedure. "Are you outside my office standing in the snow?" she asked, walking to the kitchen, which she assumed was bug-free. "No, I'm in Pikeville meeting with some investigators. I enjoyed last night. Slept warm and sound. You?" "I slept well. What time did you leave this morning?" "Just after 4. I'm not sleeping much these days, you know. Somebody's back there, always watching. Kinda hard to sleep." "Okay. What's on your mind?" "Saturday, hiking around Gray Mountain in the snow. Grilling a steak on the cabin porch. Drinking some red wine. Reading by the fire. That sort of thing. Are you up to it?" "Let me think about it." "What's there to think about?" "I'll bet that if you glance over at your calendar, you'll see that there's nothing written down for this Saturday. Go ahead." "I'm busy right now. I'll have to call you back." Though it had not been mentioned by anyone at the clinic, Samantha was learning that the cold weather and short days of January slowed business considerably. The phone rang less, and Barb spent more time away from her desk, always running errands. Claudel was 8 months pregnant and on bed rest. The courts, never in a hurry, clunked along at even slower paces. Maddie and Annette were as busy as ever with existing cases, but new ones were not dropping in. It was as if conflict and misery took a break as the wintertime blues settled in, at least for some. As Samantha was puttering around the office after dark on Friday, she heard the front door open. Maddie was still in with her door closed. Everyone else was gone for the weekend. Samantha walked to the reception area and said hello to Buddy and Mavis Reiser. They had no appointment. They had not called. Instead, they had driven an hour and a half from West Virginia to Brady late on a Friday afternoon to seek solace and guidance from their attorney. She hugged them both and knew immediately that their world had come to an end. She showed them to the conference room and offered a soft drink. They declined. She closed the door, asked what was going on, and both started crying. Buddy had been fired by Lone Rock Coal that morning. The foreman said he was physically unfit to work, thus the immediate termination. No exit package, no farewell bonus, no cheap watch for a job well done, and certainly no golden parachute. Just a hard kick in the ass, with a promise that the last paycheck was in the mail. He'd barely made it home when he collapsed on the sofa and tried to collect himself. "I got nothing," he said between breaths, as Mavis wiped tears and rattled away. "I've got nothing." "Just like that, he's out of work," Mavis said. "No paycheck, no black lung benefits, and no prospect of finding any kind of work. All he's ever done is work in the coal fields. What's he supposed to do now? You gotta help us, Samantha. You gotta do something. This ain't right."
"She knows it ain't right," Buddy said.
Each word was labored as his chest rose and fell with each noisy breath.
"But there's nothing you can do. They busted our union 20 years ago, so we got no protection from the company. Nothing."
Samantha listened with great sympathy. It was odd to see such a tough guy like Buddy wiping his cheeks with the back of his hand. His eyes were red and puffy. Normally, he would have been embarrassed at such emotion. But now, there was nothing to hide. "Eventually," she said, "we've filed our claim, and we have a strong report from the doctor. That's all we can do right now."
Unfortunately, in the states around here, an employee can be terminated at will for any cause, or for no cause. She thought the obvious, but wasn't about to mention it. Buddy was in no shape to work. As much as she despised Lone Rock Coal, she understood why the company would not want an employee in his condition operating heavy equipment. There was a long silence, broken only by Maddie, who pecked on the door and stepped inside. She greeted the risers, realized an unpleasant meeting was underway, and started a quick exit. "I'll see you for dinner, Sam." "I'll be there. Around 7? The door closed, and they returned to the silence. Mavis finally said, "It took my cousin 11 years to get his black lung benefits. He's on oxygen now. My uncle, 9. I hear the average is something like 5 years. That about right?" "For contested claims, yes, 5 to 7 is the average." "I'll be dead in 5 years," Buddy said. And they thought about this. No one argued with him. "But you said all claims are contested, right?" Mavis asked. "I'm afraid so." Buddy just shook his head, slightly but without stopping. Mavis went silent and stared at the table. He coughed a few times and seemed on the verge of a gagging fit, but managed to swallow hard and fight it. His deep, desperate breaths sounded like muffled roars from within. He cleared his throat again and said, "You know, I should have got my benefits 10 years ago. And if I had, I could have got out of the mines and found work somewhere else. I was only 30 back then. The kids were little. And I could have done something else. Away from the dust, you know? Something that didn't make the disease any worse. But the company fought me, and it won. And so I had no choice but to keep working in the mines and keep breathing the dust. I could tell it was getting worse. You just know it. It creeps up on you, but you know that walking up the 4 steps to the front porch is harder than it was a year ago. Walking to the end of the driveway takes a bit longer. Not much, but things get slower." A pause for deep breaths. Mavis reached over and patted his hand. "I remember those guys in court, in front of the administrative law judge. 3 or 4 of them, all in dark suits and shiny black shoes, all strutting around so important. They would look over at us like we was white trash. You know, just an ignorant coal miner with his ignorant wife. Just another deadbeat trying to game the system for a monthly check. I can see them right now. Arrogant little shits. So smart and smug and cocky. 'Cause they knew how to win. And we didn't. I know it's not very Christian-like to hate, but I really, really despise those guys. It's even worse now because we know the truth. And the truth is that those crooks knew I had black lung. They knew, yet they covered it up. They lied to the court. They brought in another set of lying doctors who said, under oath, that I didn't have black lung. Everybody lied, and they won. They kicked me out of court, put me back in the mines for 10 years now." He stopped and rubbed his eyes with his fingers. They cheated. They won. And they'll do it again because they write the rules. I guess there's no way to stop them. They got the money, the power, the doctors, and I guess the judges. Some system.
There's no way to stop them, Samantha, Mavis pleaded.
A lawsuit, I guess. The one Donovan filed. And there's still a chance that another firm might refile it. We haven't given up. But you're not taking the case, right?
Mavis, I've explained this before. I'm from New York, okay? I'm an intern, here for only a few months, then gone. I cannot initiate a lawsuit that will take 5 years of pretty intense litigation in federal court. We've covered this, right?
Neither responded. Minutes passed as the offices grew even quieter. The only sound was Buddy's painful breathing. He cleared his throat again and said,
Look, Samantha, you're the only lawyer we've ever had. The only one who's ever been willing to help us. If we'd had a lawyer 10 years ago, maybe things would be different. But anyway, we can't go back there. We drove over here today to say one thing, and that's to thank you for taking my case.
And being so kind to us, Mavis said, jumping in. We thank the Lord every day for you and your willingness to help us.
It means more than you'll ever know.
Just having a real lawyer out there fighting for us means so much.
Both were crying again. Chapter 34. Her first glimpse of Gray Mountain had been by air. Her second had been by boat and four-wheeler, a much more intimate visit, 2.5 weeks before last Christmas. Her third was by pickup truck, a more traditional means in those parts. Jeff picked her up in Knox, where she left her car in the same library parking lot. One look at the truck and she said,
You get a new one?
It was a massive vehicle, a Dodge something or other, and definitely not the one she'd seen before.
No, it belongs to a friend, he said, vague as always.
In the back were two red kayaks, a cooler, and several backpacks.
Let's go.
They left town in a hurry. He seemed tense, and his eyes kept darting from one mirror to the other. Are those canoes back there? She asked.
No, they're kayaks.
Okay. What does one do with a kayak?
You've never been in a kayak?
Again, I'm from the city.
Okay, with a kayak, one goes kayaking.
Or one sits by the fire with a book and a glass of wine? I'm not getting wet. You hear?
Relax, Sam.
I still prefer Samantha, especially from the guy I'm currently sleeping with. Sam is okay when it's my father, never my mother. And now, Maddie can get away with it. Sammy will get a person slapped. It's confusing, okay, but for now, why don't you just stick with Samantha?
It's your name. I'm getting sex with no string, so I'll call you whatever you want.
Get right to the point, don't you? He laughed and turned up the stereo. Faith Hill. They left the main highway and bounced along a narrow county road. As they began a steep ascent,
He suddenly turned onto a gravel road, one that ran along a ridge with forbidding canyons below. She tried not to look, but flashed back to her first adventure with Donovan, when they climbed to the top of Dublin Mountain and looked down at the Enid mine site. Vic had startled them, and then they were spotted by security. It seemed so long ago, and now Donovan was dead. Jeff turned again and again. "I'm sure you know where you're going," she said, but only to register concern. "I grew up here," he said, without looking. A dirt trail, still half covered with snow, stopped at a dead end. Through the trees, she could see the cabin. As they were unloading the truck, she asked, "What about the kayaks? I'm not hauling these things." "We'll have to check the creek. I'm afraid the water might be too low." They lifted the small cooler and backpacks from the truck and carried them to the cabin 50 yards away. The snow was 4 inches deep and covered with the tracks of animals. There appeared to be no boot prints or signs of human visitors. Samantha was pleased that she noticed such things. A real mountain girl now. He unlocked the cabin, entered slowly as if he might disturb something, and looked around. They placed the cooler in the small kitchen and the backpacks on a sofa. "Are those cameras still out there?" she asked. "Yes, and we just triggered them." "Any trespassers lately?" "Not that I know of." "When's the last time you were here?" "It's been a long time. Too much traffic raises suspicions. Let's check the creek." They walked over some rocks at the edge of the stream. Jeff said it was too low for the kayaks. Instead, they followed it deep into the hillsides, far away from the cabin and any land owned by his family. Though she wasn't sure, she thought they were going west, away from Gray Mountain. With the ground covered in snow, it was impossible to find trails, not that they were needed. Jeff, like his brother, moved through the terrain as if he walked it daily. They began a climb that grew steeper, and at one point stopped for water and a granola bar. He explained that they were on Chalk Ridge, a long, steep hill that was thick with coal and owned by people who would never sell. The Cosgrove family, from Knox. Donovan and Jeff had grown up with the Cosgrove kids. Good folks, and so on. They climbed another 500 feet and crested the ridge. In the distance, Jeff pointed out Gray Mountain. Even covered with a white blanket, it looked bare, desolate, violated. It was also far away, and after an hour trudging through the snow, her feet were beginning to freeze. She decided to wait a few more minutes before complaining. As they began a descent, shots rang out, loud, thunderous cracks of gunfire that echoed through the hills. She wanted to hit the ground, but Jeff was unfazed. "Just deer hunters," he said, barely breaking stride. He had a backpack, but no rifle. She was certain, though, that there was a weapon somewhere in there with the granola bars. Finally, when she was convinced they were hopelessly lost in the woods, she asked, "Are we headed back to the cabin?" He glanced at his watch and said, "Sure, it's getting late. Are you cold?" "My feet are frozen." "Has anyone ever told you that you have beautiful toes?" "Happens every day. No, seriously." "Am I blushing?" "No, Jeff. I can honestly say that I do not remember anyone ever saying that." "It's true." "Thanks, I guess. Let's go thaw them." The route back took almost twice as long as the venture out, and the valley was dark when they found the cabin. Jeff quickly built a fire, and the chill was replaced by a smoky warmth that Samantha could soon feel in her bones. He lit 3 gas lanterns, and as he hauled in enough firewood for the night, she unpacked the cooler and inspected dinner. 2 steaks, 2 potatoes, and 2 ears of corn. There were 3 bottles of Merlot, carefully selected by Jeff because of their screw-off caps. They drank the first cup as they warmed by the fire and talked about politics. Obama would take the oath in a few days, and Jeff was contemplating a road trip to D.C. for the festivities. Her father, long before his fall, had been active in the Democratic politics of the plaintiff's bar and now seemed to be regaining his enthusiasm for the fight. He had invited her to come share the moment. She liked the idea of watching history, but wasn't sure of her schedule. She had told no one about the offer from Andy, and she would not bring it up now. Doing so would only complicate things. Halfway through the second cup, he asked, "How are the toes?" "They're tingling," she said. They were still tucked away in thick woolen socks, socks she planned to keep on regardless of what happened. He went to light the charcoal on the porch, and before long they were preparing dinner. They ate by candlelight on a primitive table built for two. After dinner, they attempted to read novels by the light of the fire, but quickly abandoned that idea for more pressing and important matters. She awoke in the midst of the quilts and blankets, naked except for her socks, and it took a few seconds to realize Jeff was not somewhere in the pile. Coals smoldered in the fireplace as the last of the logs burned out. She found a flashlight and called his name, but he wasn't in the cabin. She checked her watch. 4:40 a.m., pitch black outside. She walked to the porch, shined the light over it, softly called his name, then quickly returned to her warm spot by the fire. She refused to panic. He wouldn't leave her alone if she were in danger. Or would he? She put on jeans and a shirt and tried to sleep, but she was too wired. She was also frightened. And as the minutes ticked by, she tried to stifle her anger. Alone in a dark cabin deep in the woods, this was not supposed to happen. Every sound from the outside could be a threat. 5 o'clock crept by. She almost dozed off, but caught herself. She had brought a small backpack with a toothbrush and a change of clothes. He had hauled in 3 large ones of the serious backpacker variety. She had noticed them immediately in the back of the truck in Knox, and she had glanced at them occasionally. He used one for the hike. The other two appeared to be stuffed with something. They had been tossed on the sofa at first, then placed by the door. Now, they were gone. She took off her jeans and shirt and flung them on the sofa, as if nothing had happened. When she was still and warm again, she took deep breaths and assessed the situation. What was obvious became more so. For those watching Jeff's every move, today's visit to Gray Mountain was nothing more than a romantic getaway. The kayaks were a nice touch, bright and red, and stacked in the back of the truck for all to see, but never close to actually getting wet. Kayaking, hiking, grilling on the porch, snuggling by the fire. Just a pleasant little tryst with the new girl in town. In the early hours of the morning, when the valley was at its stillest, he awoke and eased away with the skill of a cat burglar. At that moment, he was deep in the bowels of Gray Mountain, stuffing the backpacks with invaluable papers filched from Kroll mining. He was using her for cover. The door opened, and her heart froze. She couldn't see it in the pitch blackness, and the sofa was blocking it too. She was lying on a thick mat layered with quilts and blankets, trying to breathe normally, and praying that the person over there was Jeff. He stood perfectly still for what seemed like an hour, then moved slightly. When he placed his jeans on the sofa, the belt buckle rattled slightly. When he was undressed, he gently eased back under the covers, careful not to touch her or wake her. She really hoped that naked man inches away was Jeff Gray. Feigning sleep, she rolled over and flung an arm across his chest. He pretended to be startled and mumbled something. She mumbled back, satisfied that she, in fact, knew the guy. With a hand that was a bit too cold for the occasion, he fondled her rear end. She mumbled no and turned away. He moved closer, then pretended to fall asleep. Before she drifted off, she decided to play along with the game for the time being. Give it some time and thought, and keep an eye on those backpacks. The cat burglar was moving again, now slowly getting to his feet and reaching for the stack of wood. He tossed two logs on the fire, stoked it, and whispered, "Are you awake?" "I think so," she said. "This place is freezing." He was on his knees, lifting covers and reburying himself next to her. "Let's sleep some more," he said, groping, going for the body heat. She grunted something in reply, as if she'd been in a coma. The fire was popping and crackling. The chill was suddenly gone, and Samantha managed to finally drift away. Chapter 35. The forecast for Monday was a high of 55 degrees and lots of sunshine. The last of the snow was melting quickly as Samantha walked to work. January 12th, but it almost felt like spring. She unlocked the office and went about her early morning routine. The first email was from Isabel. "Hey, Sam. Andy said he's made contact and you're almost on board. He made me promise not to discuss the job and the specifics, afraid we'll compare notes and try to squeeze him for a better package, I guess. Can't say that I've really missed him that much. You? I certainly haven't missed the firm and the city, and not sure I'm going back. I told Andy I'd take the job, but having second thoughts. I certainly can't drop everything and be there in a month. You? Nor have I missed the thrill of reading and revising contracts 10 hours a day. I need the money and all, but I'm surviving okay, and I really enjoy the work. As I've told you, we advocate for kids who have been prosecuted as adults and are stuck in adult prisons. Don't get me started. The work is fascinating as well as depressing, but each day I feel like I'm making a small difference. We walked a kid out of prison last week. His parents were waiting by the gate and everyone was in tears, including me. FYI, one of the other new associates at Spain and Grubman is that turd Silvio from Tax. Remember him? The worst halitosis in the entire firm. Knock you down from the other side of the conference table. And he insists on talking nose to nose. Spits, too. Gross. FYI, according to unnamed sources, one of the blue ribbon clients at Spain and Grubman will be Chuck Randover, that great indictment dodger who thinks just because he's paying you $900 an hour, he has the right to rub your ass. You know him too well. But you didn't hear this from me. FYI, serious second thoughts. You, Izzy." Samantha chuckled as she read the email and wasted no time firing one right back. "Iz, I don't know what Andy is smoking or telling, but I haven't said yes. And if he's playing this fast and loose with the facts, it sort of makes me question everything else he says. No, I cannot pack up and leave here in a month, not with a clear conscience. I'm thinking of asking for a start date a few months down the road, say around September 1st. Randover was the only client who ever made me cry. He He ridiculed me once in a meeting. I held things together until I could get to the restroom. And that chump Andy sat right there and watched it happen. No thought of protecting his people. No way. He wasn't about to cross a client. I was wrong, but it was such a simple and harmless mistake. Any idea what the package will be? Isabel replied, I swore I wouldn't divulge it. But it's impressive. Later. The first surprise of the day came in the mail. Top Market Solutions sent a check for $11,300, made payable to Pamela Booker, with the required releases attached. Samantha made a copy of the check and planned to frame it. Her first lawsuit and her first victory. She proudly showed it to Maddie, who suggested that she drive it over to the lamp factory and surprise her client. An hour later, she entered the town of Brushy and found the near-vacant industrial park on the edge of town. She said hello to Mr. Simmons and again thanked him for rehiring Pamela. On break, Pamela signed the release and cried over the check. She had never seen so much money and seemed thoroughly overwhelmed. They were sitting in Samantha's car in the parking lot, among a sad collection of ancient pickup trucks and dirty little imports. I'm not sure what to do with this, she said. As a multi-talented legal aid lawyer, Samantha had a bit of financial advice. Well, first, don't tell anyone, period. Open your mouth and you'll have all sorts of new friends. How much is your credit card debt? Couple thousand. Pay it off, then cut up your cards. No debt for at least a year. Use cash and write checks, but no credit cards. Are you serious? You need a car, so I'd put $2,000 down on one and finance the rest over 2 years. Pay off your other bills and put $5,000 in a savings account, then forget about it. How much of this do you get? Zero. We don't take fees, except in rare cases. It's all yours, Pamela, and you deserve every dime of it. Now hurry and stick it in the bank before those crooks bounce it. With her lips twitching and tears dripping off her cheeks, she reached over and hugged her lawyer. Thank you, Samantha. Thank you. Thank you. Driving away, she looked in her rearview mirror. Pamela was standing, watching, waving. Samantha wasn't crying, but she had a tightness in her throat. The second surprise of the day came during the Monday brown bag lunch. Just as Barb was telling a story about a man who'd fainted in church yesterday, Maddie's cell phone vibrated on the table beside her salad. Caller unknown. She said hello, and a strangely familiar but unidentified voice said, The FBI will be there in 30 minutes with a search warrant. Back up your files immediately. Her jaw dropped as the color drained from her face. Who is this? She asked. The caller was gone. She calmly repeated the message, and everyone took a deep, fearful breath. Judging from the tactics used when the FBI raided Donovan's office, it was safe to assume they would walk out with just about everything they could carry. The first frantic order of business would be to find some flash drives and start downloading the important data from their desktops. We're assuming this is also related to Kroll Mining, Annette said, looking suspiciously at Samantha. Maddie was rubbing her temples, trying to stay calm. There's nothing else. The feds must think we have something because I'm the attorney for Donovan's estate. Bizarre, absurd, outrageous. I can't think of enough adjectives. We have nothing they haven't already seen. There's nothing new. To Samantha, though, the raid was far more ominous. She and Jeff had left Gray Mountain Sunday morning, and she was assuming the backpacks were loaded with documents. Barely 24 hours later, The FBI was charging in, snooping on behalf of Kroll Mining. It was a fishing expedition, but also an act of effective intimidation. She mentioned nothing, but hurried to her office and began transferring data. The women whispered as they scurried about. Annette had the bright idea of volunteering Barb to leave with their laptops. They would explain that she was driving over to Wise to have them serviced by a technician. Barb gathered them and was more than happy to leave town. Maddie called Hump, who was one of the better criminal lawyers in town, retained him on the spot, and asked him to saunter over once the raid started. Hump said he wouldn't miss it for anything. When the flash drives were loaded, Samantha placed them in a large envelope, along with her spy phone, and walked down to the courthouse. On the third floor, the county maintained a long-neglected law library that hadn't been cleaned in years. She hid the envelope in a pile of dusty ABA journals from the 1970s and hurried back to the office. Agents Frohmeyer and Banahan wore dark suits and led the fearless team as it barged into the heavily fortified offices of the Mountain Legal Aid Clinic. Three other agents, all in navy parkas with FBI stenciled from shoulder to shoulder in yellow letters as large and as bright as possible, followed their leaders. Maddie met them in the front hallway with, "Oh no, not you again," Frohmeyer said. "Afraid so. Here's the search warrant." She took it and said, "I don't have time to read it. Just tell me what it covers." Any and all records relating to the legal files from the law offices of Donovan Gray and pertaining to correspondence, litigation, etc., relative to what is commonly known as the Hammer Valley case. "You got it all last time, Frohmeyer. He's been dead 7 weeks. You think he's still producing paperwork?"
"I'm just following orders."
"Right, right. Look, Mr. Frohmeyer, his files are still over there, across the street. The file I have here is his probate file. We're not involved in the litigation. Understand? It's not complicated."
"I have my orders."
Hump made a noisy entrance, barking,
"I represent the clinic. What the hell is this all about?"
Annette and Samantha were watching from their open doors. Maddie said, "Hump, this is Agent Frohmeyer, the leader of this little posse. He thinks he has the right to take all of our files and computers." Annette suddenly barked,
"Like hell you do. I don't have a single piece of paper in my office that's even remotely related to Donovan Gray or any of his cases. What I do have is an office full of sensitive and confidential files and cases involving such things as divorce, child molestation, domestic abuse, paternity, addiction and rehab, mental incompetency, and a long, sad list of human misery. And you, sir, are not entitled to see any of it. If you try to touch any of it, I'll resist with all the physical might I can muster. Arrest me, if you will. But I promise you, first thing tomorrow morning, I'll file a federal lawsuit with your name, Mr. Frohmeyer, and the names of the rest of you goons, front and center as defendants. After that, I'll hound you to hell and back." It took a lot to stun a tough guy like Frohmeyer, but for a second, his shoulders slumped, slightly. The other four listened, wide-eyed and uncertain. Samantha almost laughed out loud. Maddie was actually grinning. "Very well put, Miss Brevard," Hump said. "That sums up our position nicely. And I'll be happy to call the U.S. attorney right now and clarify things."
Maddie said, "There are over 200 active files and 1,000 more in storage, none of which have anything to do with Donovan Gray and his business. Do you really want to haul them back to your office and dig through them?" Annette snarled, "Surely you have better things to do." Hump raised both hands and called for quiet. Frohmeyer stiffened his back and glared at Samantha. We'll start with your office. If we find what we're looking for, we'll take it and leave.
And what might that be?
Read the search warrant.
Hump asked.
How many files do you have, Miss Kofor?
Around 15, I think.
Hump said. Okay, let's do this. Let's place her files on the conference room table, and you boys have a look. Go through her office and inspect whatever you want. But before you remove anything, let's have a chat. Okay?
We're taking her computers, desktop and laptop, Frohmeyer said. The sudden interest in Samantha's files was puzzling to Maddie and Annette. Samantha shrugged as if she had no idea.
My laptop is not here, she said.
Where is it? Frohmeyer snapped.
The technician has it. Some type of bug, I think.
When did you take it in?
Hump threw up another hand.
She doesn't have to answer that. The search warrant doesn't give you the right to interrogate potential witnesses.
Frohmeyer took a deep breath, fumed for a second, then gave them a sappy grin. He followed Samantha to her office and watched closely as she removed her files from the Army surplus cabinet.
Nice place you got here, he said, like a real smartass. Won't take long to search this office.
Samantha ignored him. She carried her files to the conference room, where Banahan and another agent began flipping through them. She returned to her office and watched Frohmeyer slowly poke through her two file cabinets and the drawers to her rickety desk. He touched every piece of paper but took nothing. She hated him for invading her private space. One agent followed Maddie into her office. Another followed Annette. Drawer by drawer, they looked at all the files, but removed nothing. Hump walked from door to door, watching and waiting for an altercation.
Are all the laptops gone? Frohmeyer asked Hump when he finished digging through Samantha's office.
Annette heard the question and said,
Yes, we sent them all together.
How convenient. Guess we'll be back with another search warrant.
All fun and games.
They picked through hundreds of retired files. Three of them climbed into the attic and pulled out records Maddie hadn't seen in decades. The excitement gave way to monotony. Hump sat in the hallway and shot the bull with Frohmeyer while the ladies tried to return calls. After 2 hours, the raid lost steam, and the agents left, taking with them nothing but Samantha's desktop computer. As she watched it leave, she felt like the helpless victim in a backward country where the police ran rampant and rights were non-existent. It was simply wrong. She was being bullied by the cops because of her association with Jeff. Now, her property was being confiscated, and her client's confidentiality was compromised. She had never felt so helpless. The last thing she needed was a good grilling at the hands of Maddie and Annette. They had to be highly suspicious of her at this point. How much did she know about the Kroll matter? What had Jeff told her? Had she seen any of the documents? She managed to sneak out the back door and retrieve the flash drives and spy phone from the law library. She went for another long drive. Jeff was not answering the phone, and this irritated her. Right now, she needed him. Maddie was waiting when she returned to the office at dark. The laptops were back, safe and untouched.
Let's go sit on the porch and have a glass of wine. Maddie said, we need to talk.
Is Chester cooking?
Well, we never skip dinner.
They had a nice stroll to Maddie's house and decided along the way it was too chilly for porch sitting. Chester was busy elsewhere, so they were alone. They sat in the den and had a sip or two before Maddie said, now, Tell me everything.
Okay.
Chapter 36. At about the same time, Buddy Reiser parked his pickup truck at a scenic overlook and walked 200 yards along a trail to a picnic area. He sat on a table, put a gun in his mouth, and pulled the trigger. Two campers found his body late Monday night and called 911. Mavis, who'd been on the phone for hours, got the knock on the door. Panicked neighbors rushed over. The house was chaos. Samantha was sleeping soundly when her cell phone began vibrating. She did not hear it. Absent an arrest, why would anyone feel the need to call his or her lawyer at midnight on a Monday? She checked it at 5:30, soon after she awoke in the fog of reliving the FBI raid. There were three missed calls from Mavis Reiser, the last one at 12:40. A message in a trembling voice delivered the news. Samantha suddenly forgot about the FBI. She was really growing weary of all this death. Donovan still haunted her. Francine Crump's was not untimely, but its aftermath was causing problems. 2 days before, on Gray Mountain, Samantha had again seen the white cross marking the spot where Rose took her life. She had never met the Tate boys, but felt an attachment to their tragedy. She often thought of Maddie's father and the way Black Lung killed him. Life could be harsh in the coal fields, and at that moment, she missed the rough streets of the big city. Now, her favorite client was dead, and she was facing another funeral. She put on jeans and a parka and went for a walk. As the sky began to lighten, she shivered in the cold and once again asked herself what exactly was she doing in Brady, Virginia. Why was she crying over a coal miner she had met only 3 months earlier? Why not just leave? As always, there were no simple answers. She saw a kitchen light on at Maddie's and pecked on the window. Chester, in his bathrobe, was making coffee. He let her in and went to fetch Maddie, who was supposedly awake. She took the news hard, and for a long time, the two lawyers sat at the kitchen table and tried to make sense out of a senseless tragedy. Somewhere in the pile of the Reiser's records, Samantha had seen a payment on a life insurance policy of $50,000. "Isn't there some type of exclusion for suicide?" she asked, cradling her cup with both hands. "Typically, yes, but it's only for the first year or so. If not, then a person could load up on insurance and jump off a bridge. If Buddy's policy is older, then the exclusion has probably expired." "So, it looks like he killed himself for the money." "Who knows? A person who commits suicide is not thinking rationally. But I suspect we'll find out that life insurance was a factor. He had no job, no benefits, and their small savings account was gone. That plus three kids at home and a wife with no job. He was facing years of even more bad health, and the end would not be pretty. Every coal miner knows a victim of the disease. Things start to add up. They do. Would you like some breakfast? Maybe a piece of toast?" "No, thanks. I feel like I just left here." "I guess I did." As Maddie topped off their coffees, Samantha said, "I have a hypothetical for you. A tough one. If Buddy had a lawyer 10 years ago, what would have happened to his case?" Maddie stirred in some sugar and frowned as she considered this. "You never know, but if you assume the lawyer was on the ball and found the medical records you discovered, and that he, or she, brought Casper Slate's fraud and cover-up to the court's attention somewhere along the way, then you have to believe he would have been awarded benefits. Just speculating here, but I have a hunch Casper Slate would have acted quickly in order to keep their crimes away from the court. They would have conceded the claim, folded their tent, so to speak, and Buddy would have received his checks. And he wouldn't have been breathing more coal dust for the past 10 years. Probably not. The benefits aren't great, but they could have survived. They sat in perfect silence for a while, neither wanting to speak or move. Chester appeared in the doorway with an empty cup, saw them frozen in deep thought, and disappeared without a sound. Finally, Maddie pushed back and stood. She reached for the wheat bread and put 2 slices in the toaster. From the fridge, she withdrew butter and jam. After a couple of bites, Samantha said, "I really don't want to go to the office today. It feels violated, you know? My computer got snatched yesterday. All my files were rifled through. Both Jeff and Donovan thought the place was bugged. I need a break. Take a personal day, or two. You know we don't care. Thanks. I'm leaving town, and I'll see you tomorrow." She left Brady and drove an hour before allowing herself 1 glance into the rearview mirror. No one. Nothing. Jeff called twice, but she refused to answer. At Roanoke, she headed east, away from the Shenandoah Valley and the interstate traffic. With hours to kill, she worked the phone, arranging details, leaning on people as she meandered through central Virginia. In Charlottesville, she had lunch with a friend from the Georgetown days. At 10 minutes before 6 p.m., she took her position at a corner table at the bar in the Hay Adams Hotel, 1 block from the White House. Neutral turf was required. Marshall Kofer arrived first, promptly at 6, looking as dapper as ever. He had readily agreed to the meeting. Karen had been a bit more reluctant. In the end, though, her daughter needed help. What her daughter really needed was for her parents to listen and provide some guidance. Karen was only 5 minutes late. She hugged Samantha, pecked her ex properly on the cheek, and sat down. A waiter took their drink orders. The table was away from the bar, so there was privacy, for the moment anyway. Samantha would be in charge of the talking. It was her show all the way, and she would not allow any awkward pauses as her parents sat down together for the first time in at least 11 years. She had told them on the phone that this was not a social event, and it was certainly not a misguided effort to patch up old issues. More important matters were at hand. The drinks arrived, and everyone reached for a glass. Samantha thanked them for their time, apologized for the short notice, then plunged into her narrative. She began with the Hammer Valley litigation, and coal mining, and Donovan Gray and his lawsuit. Marshall had known the facts for some time, and Karen had heard most of it just after Christmas. But neither knew about the stolen documents, and Samantha spared no details. She had actually seen them, and was assuming they were still buried deep in Gray Mountain, or at least most of them. Kroll Mining was after them, and now the FBI had been enlisted to do its dirty work. She admitted she was seeing Jeff, but assured them it was nothing serious. Frankly, she owed them no explanations. Both feigned disinterest in her new relationship. The waiter was back. They ordered another round and something to snack on. Samantha described her meeting in New York with Jarrett London and his efforts to pressure her and Jeff into delivering the documents as soon as possible. She admitted she felt like she was getting sucked into activity that, if not illegal, was clearly questionable. She had now been the target of an FBI raid, which, though misguided, had certainly been dramatic and frightening. As far as she knew, the U.S. attorney in West Virginia was spearheading the investigation and evidently was convinced that Kroll Mining was the victim of a theft and conspiracy. It should have been the other way around, she argued. Kroll Mining was the guilty party and should be brought to justice. Marshall agreed wholeheartedly. He asked a few questions, all of them aimed at the U.S. attorney and the attorney general. Karen was cautious in her comments and questions. What Marshall was thinking, but could never say, was that Karen had most likely used her considerable influence to bust him and send him to prison a decade earlier. With clout like that, why couldn't she help her daughter now? A cheese platter arrived, but they ignored it. Both parents agreed that she should not touch the documents. Let Jeff run the risks if he so chose, but she should leave them alone. Jarrett London and his band of litigators had the brains and money to handle the dirty work, and if the documents were as valuable as they believed, they would figure out a way to nail Kroll Mining. Can you get the FBI to back off? Samantha asked her mother. Karen said she would give it her immediate attention, but cautioned that she had little influence with those guys. The hell you don't, Marshall almost mumbled. He had sat in prison for 3 years and schemed of ways to retaliate against his ex-wife and her colleagues. But, with time, he accepted the reality that his problems had been caused by his own greed. Have you thought about simply leaving? Her mother asked. Pack up and get out? Call it an adventure and hustle back to the city? You gave it your best shot, and now you've got the FBI breathing down your neck. What are you doing there? Marshall seemed sympathetic to this line of questioning. He'd served time with some white-collar guys who, technically, had broken no laws. If the feds want to get you, they'll figure out a way. Conspiracy was one of their favorites. The more Samantha talked, the more she wanted to talk. She could not remember the last time she'd had the undivided attention of both parents. In fact, she was not sure it had ever happened. Perhaps as a toddler, but then, who could remember? And listening to her worries and troubles, both parents seemed to forget their own issues and rally to support her. The baggage was left behind, for the moment anyway. Why did she feel compelled to stay down there? She answered by telling the story of Buddy Reiser and his claim for black lung benefits. Her throat tightened when she told them of his suicide about 24 hours ago. She would go to a funeral soon, at a pretty church out in the country, and watch from a distance as poor Maeve